Ed Neil, welcome back to Geological.
Thanks. It's nice to be with you.
So, I always enjoy our conversations. So, last time we were visiting, we ended talking about sort of cosmic influences. We were looking at the six chi, right? The Liao Jing. I don't know if there's a good translation in English for Liao Jing. Six fa was it six divisions, six confirmations? Have you got a good translation for that?
Well, when we're talking about Liao Jing, we're talking about six channels, basically. So sometimes that gets transposed over to climates, but actually they have a different name, which is Liu Qi. So which it means the climate factors. When we talk about Liao Jing, we're talking really well, on one sense we're talking about the human body, Tai Yin, Yang Ming, those kinds of things, upper and lower. And then we're talking about a pattern in nature because the body's templated on patterns in nature. So both of those. But when we're talking about climate in particular, we're talking about something a little different.
But they're connected, right? Because when we think about like the climactic factor of dampness, that resonates with the tie-in.
Yes, absolutely. The Neijing perspective is that the universe is a resonance system, and that things, it's like a bunch of different sounds or tuning forks that are happening, and they're resonating back and forth with each other. So, for example, there's the turning of the stars around the pole star, which in the Neijing was called five circulations. That was the original meaning of that term. And that resonates in the five level organ systems. So there's a resonance system between the stars and the internal organs, the liver, the kidney, the lungs, and so forth. We get tripped up because, as Westerners, we tend to think of things in terms of form and energy, break that down, and kind of have that dichotomy,
Right, mind and body.
mind and body. But that's really not the way nature operates. It's more an artifact of our way of thinking and our need to kind of put things in boxes and so forth. So in the Neijing system, the idea, it's more helpful to think about tangibility versus intangibility, meaning that there's resonance patterns. Like, for example, you throw a stone in a pond or something like that, or you have a tuning fork and it makes sound waves. And some of those resonance patterns are tangible and some of them are intangible. So when they're intangible, we call them Qi, well, that's one way of talking about it. When they're tangible, we call them xing or form. So if you imagine, actually, this kind of gets back to an underlying issue in Chinese medicine, which is the issue of terminology in general, which is a huge problem for us right now. And it speaks to the fact that we think we're talking about the same things. We're actually usually not talking about the same things.
God, that's just like in a marriage
Just like in a marriage.
or any relationship, right? We think we know what we're talking about. We think we're communicating clearly, but the person on the other side might have a whole different idea of what's going on. And unless we put in some sort of feedback mechanism, it's very easy to get tripped up.
Yeah, it's exactly true. And in Chinese medicine, we have the situation that we're like in a marriage, we're living in our own thought bubbles. So, for example, if you ask me, what's this thing, Liao Jing? You have a certain idea about it from your experience and your teachers and so forth. And I have another one. We're actually talking about very different things. And I didn't really understand the depth of this until I was invited to speak at a conference several years ago and be on a board addressing the question, what is qi? And that was the question for the evening. And it was various luminaries and experienced people. And looking back on that talk, I realized I was expecting two things from the evening. One was that we would pretty much agree on what qi is, but we'd be talking about the nuances and something like that. And the other thing was that we would be referencing what Chinese people had said about qi. So if you look at these terms in Chinese medicine, the important ones all have an intellectual history. That means people have commented about them. They're expressed different in different texts. There's a whole tradition around the characters. So I had the feeling we were going to be talking about that. I was sitting down on one end of the table and people started talking. And the first person said, "Qi is, when I'm doing energy work, it's the heat that comes out of my hands." And the next person said, "Qi is the energy or the ability of the body, it's what repairs the body when we're sick." And the next person says, "Qi is the autonomic nervous system." And the next person And the next person said, "Qi is love." Mm-hmm. And by the time it got down to me at the end, I didn't know what to say.
I was just thinking as we're having this conversation, it gets down to you and you're going, "I got no idea."
Actually, I think I said something like, "I don't understand anything that's been said here tonight."
Wow. Yeah. Because what a great conversation that night.
And the other thing that had troubled me was that we had not mentioned one philosopher making a statement about Qi. Mm-hmm. And so that's when it really came home to me, this issue of terminology. I was in Germany this spring at the Rotenberg conference, and Stephen Birch gave a very interesting paper about his work with the study of how people define blood stasis. And he worked with a team to go around and ask experienced people, "What is the definition of blood stasis?" And it turned out there was almost no agreement. So it was just so startling.
These are such fundamental bones that we hang our medicine on.
Exactly. And the issue is, if we don't agree on terminology to some degree, then we're living in our own worlds. That's one issue. But we can't have innovation. So we can't innovate a field if we're all talking about different things. And our research really suffers from this. So for example, now, if we're going to do a Chinese medicine study, often we'll go Western researcher, collaborate with them. They'll come and ask us what we do. We'll say, "This is how we treat knee pain," or whatever. We don't actually agree on the terms we're using. And then we're asking someone who knows nothing about our system to come on board and evaluate the system. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways I experienced this personally, you know, I was trained as a Western doctor first and then Chinese medicine doctor also. And sometimes I think about the difference between the conferences I've attended as a Western doctor or the journals I read versus the Chinese version of that, going to the conferences and so forth. And one of the real differences is lack of innovation. So when not that there is an innovation, I shouldn't say lack, but not a limit of innovation. So when I graduated from medical school, I walked up to the stage and they handed me my diploma, and the doctor there said, "Congratulations, 40% of what you just learned is out of date."
Oh, wow.
Because the profession is changing so quickly. But when I read a Western journal, say about emergency medicine, there are things in there based on agreed upon terms and it's something I implement right away and so forth. Sometimes I imagine what this would be like if I was a cardiologist and I went to a cardiology conference and that same discussion about Qi was being held about blood. Mm-hmm. So imagine that you went to a cardiology conference and there was a panel discussion and one person said, "I think blood is love." And the next person said, "I think blood is the nervous system." You know, and the next person said, "I think blood is the warmth that comes out of your face." There would be really no ability to innovate or have research and so forth. So when we look at the classics like the Neijing, which is really the defining text of Chinese medicine, meaning if you're practicing Chinese medicine, it means you're practicing theories that derive from that book in some way.
This is like our DNA.
Yeah.
Right.
So if we study the Neijing, we study it for different reasons. One is to, you know, learn about techniques they were using and pulse diagnosis systems and so forth. But the other is because it's where terminology is set down. And so when we study that, it tells us what the terms mean. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in my situation, I started to read the Neijing at the end of about 1999 and so forth, started to try and translate it. I wasn't very good, of course, but I think maybe I mentioned this in the last talk we had. Just about that time, a few years before, most early Chinese texts had been put on a database or databases in China and Taiwan.
I remember you mentioning that. So all kinds of accessibility that we didn't have before, so long as you read Chinese.
And in particular, that research was very helpful to do terminology research. So one of the issues in early texts is that the terms are different. You might look at a Chinese term and it says something that we recognize today, but in early times, they actually meant something very different.
Right. Well, we see this in English as well, right? I mean, I remember when I was a kid and growing up, the word bad meant like not good. And then Michael Jackson comes on, it's like bad. Bad is good.
No, it's good.
And, you know, you hear things, kids these days, right? Oh, man, that's sick. That means it's great. So, I mean, I think we see this in all languages. It gets, you know, we're not only dealing with, you know, the issues of, you know, culture here, but language itself morphs over time. It really helps to know the context that we're dealing with.
And that's very true for this work. So, most of my work for the last 20 years, a lot of it's been around terminology research. And the mm-hmm. way this works is we come across a term like Liu Jing or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I put it in the computer, you know, database. And I start translating the passages that use that, both in the Neijing and other early texts. And then through the translation of the passages, come to redefine the terms.
You get to know it better through the history of how you've seen it being used.
Exactly. And then taking those new terms and retranslating the text. And then what happens is you come out with a very different vision of what these people were trying to describe. Mm-hmm. And it also seems historically that a lot of this knowledge was interrupted relatively early. So where we think it that Chinese medicine now is kind of a continuous evolution of improvement and so forth. But the work I've been doing seems to show that transmission actually, especially in acupuncture, was interrupted way, way back in the very beginning. And then it deviated into another practice, which was the practice of point-based acupuncture and what we have today.
Tell me more about this interruption. I know, for example, we have the Shanghanlun, mm-hmm. which appeared in the late Han Dynasty, and then it kind of like disappears for a couple hundred years.
So if you talk to sinologists now, most of them will say that the consensus is that the Neijing was probably written in the Han times or in that period, because when you look at tombs like Ma Huangdui and others, you don't see mention of the Neijing text. So there's an assumption that it came later. But what I found in the work I've been doing is that another scenario is that it was actually primarily warring states medicine, warring states texts, when there was a time of a flourishing of a scholarly tradition. And that was interrupted at the time of the Qin, the first dynasty of China in 221, when there was a backlash against writings and scholars, and a lot of the books were burned and so forth. That the Neijing may have been held in the Qin library and then rediscovered in Han times. So the reason why we say that is because when we get into the meat of the Neijing and you try and start to use it and put things in spreadsheets and really try and nail it down, some of the things are clear are that it's a compilation text that was recording the experience of multiple schools of doctors, and that those doctors were practicing at a very high level. They were treating complex illnesses, and also that it wasn't that they had accumulated this experience over years. So this is not the experience that you just get after a year of, you know, trying something. They're very detailed in their understanding. So it's a very complex system in widespread use in multiple schools. And then we get to the Han time, and really all of a sudden that just falls away. So the narrative after the Han time is basically there are these fragments of these texts. No one understands what they mean. They're all out of order. And so if you look at the Jai Jing or Wang Bing's editions, they're trying to get this mess back in order. The other thing you don't see in Han time is really any description of doctors using these techniques. So there was a time when they were using these techniques and writing them down. In the Han time, even though there was developments of printing presses and writing and so forth, there's really no detailed writings of doctors saying, this is what I did, this is how I used this theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't see that till much, much later.
Yeah. So this has led me to use the term the Great Disruption, meaning that there was a period of time where there was a nature-based medicine that was highly evolved, and that was lost relatively early in its transmission, particularly in terms of acupuncture. And then we've been trying to reconstruct it, but it also deviated to something very different. So originally, the idea of acupuncture really was of surgery. So if you look at the 9 needle sets, that's a surgeon's kit. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the descriptions of the techniques, most of them don't talk about points. They talk about problems in tissue planes that you're getting at and doing these other things like that. The channels were clearly blood vessels back then. So they made the correlation that what they were doing, the basis of aging science is that they would look at nature, infer patterns, then say, make the assumption that the body is made on the same patterns that makes nature.
Pretty good assumption. Blood vessels look a lot like, you know, the waterways of rivers.
Right. So if we go back to that character Jing, mm-hmm. Liu Jing, the idea in the original texts were that there were, well, let me back up a little bit. I think we talked about this last time, but the basic viewpoint of a classical Chinese philosopher or an aging natural scientist is that the world, maybe we can use the analogy that the world is a stage.
Mm. We've heard that before.
Yeah, Shakespeare said that, all the world's a stage. And so on one, and there's a curtain, mm-hmm. and on one side of the curtain is everything we see, Trump, global warming, you know, our podcast, whatever. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the curtain is patterns, and they're patterns of motion, of space-time motion. So if you want to know, in the Neijing, they make the distinction between the upper-level physician and the lower-level physician. It's really that. Are you treating on the front of the curtain or behind the curtain?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you could see this in the political realm as well. Are you working with the root causes? You know, so I don't want to get into politics too much, but there's this idea of the mandate of heaven. And sometimes you get these really crappy, tyrannical rulers. Well, because behind the curtain is the mandate of heaven. At that moment in that space-time, this is what's happening.
And that's the point of view. So if you look like, for example, someone like Trump, you know, you wonder, how did we get this, you know? But we're in a time where the patterns have been overbuilt in one way, the building up patterns. And so nature invokes a breaking down pattern to restore balance. In a breaking down pattern, the patterns are chaos and breaking down and rebirth. And that's the pattern. If you look at someone like Trump, he doesn't really have that many skills. He can hardly keep an office staff together, you mm-hmm. know.
Well, good at breaking things down. And you know, let's face it, if you have a body that dies and then decomposes, you need to break that thing down before it's going to be able to reconstitute into whatever the next thing that reconstitutes into.
So the classical way of looking at that is to step back and say, it's not about him. If you remove him, the pattern's still there, actually. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's about... It's a time of breaking down, and he kind of rises to the top because that's his skill set. But anyway, to get back to medicine.
Just might be the right man for the right job.
He's maybe, unfortunately. But if you go back to the pattern language idea and mm-hmm. the idea that there's the world we see and there's the world we don't see.
Mm-hmm. The tangible and intangible that we sort of started. Actually, I want to ask you a question about that. So, and this is one of the things I love about Chinese medicine, it's all the built-in contradictions. It used to drive me crazy, and now I just kind of look at it and go, that's juicy. I wonder what it really means. I wonder what's going on here. So you were talking about being at that conference, you had the conversation about chi. And it's everything from, you know, energy going out the hands to love. And it's like, well, what are we talking about here? Well, one of the things that you mentioned is that we're dealing with a resonant universe. And so in some ways, that particular discussion speaks to the resonant aspect of this thing. And especially when you talk about chi, that's intangible. That's not tangible. So is there any way to talk about chi that doesn't rely to some degree on exploring these resonances and how they're connected?
Yeah. So as I was saying, when you go back to the Neijing text, one of its highest values is it tells us what terms mean. Mm-hmm. And they're often very different than what we believe them to be now. Mm-hmm. And there's actually there's a reason in how they made terms. And so let me take you on a thought experiment here.
All right. I'm up for it.
I'm sorry, I have to get a little bit esoteric. I'll try and limit it a bit.
I'm putting my seatbelt on.
Okay. Because they were thinking in cosmic terms also and patterns of nature. So let's start. Let's imagine that you somehow have a seat and you're watching the cosmos form or the universe form. Mm-hmm. And so you pull up and it's like before the movie starts and everything's quiet and there's nothing there. So there's a time before anything starts to move. So in the Mojing text, the Moist classic, it says, sometimes time has a duration and sometimes it doesn't. At the beginning, it doesn't have a duration. Okay, just hang on, buckle your seatbelt.
No, I mean, it's great. I mean, these kind of contradictions immediately, I mean, it just takes the conscious, rational, tangible mind and immediately like flips it off. It's like, I don't know how to make sense of that.
Well, hang on 1 second. It goes, so you got the seat and you're sitting here. And then what's the first thing that happens when the universe comes into being? It starts to move. Is what happens. So the first impulse of the universe is to move. Why it has an impulse to move, we don't know. It could be a static place with no movement, but it tends to move. And so its first impulse is to move. And that movement could be linear. It could just go off in space forever in one direction, but it happens to be that it's a movement that goes out and comes back. Mm-hmm. And so we call that breath motion. Mm-hmm. And so we say that the essential nature of the universe is breath motion. If you look at the terms, for example, in Chinese medicine, the way they make sense is that for all the important terms, they're first describing patterns of space-time motion, and then they're describing things. So for example, if you talk about that first impulse of the universe to move, the names for that of the movement out is called yang, and the term for the movement back is called yin. Okay?
Okay.
So we have a cyclical motion. We have a motion out from a root and returning back to its root. So actually, even the terms root and branch, they first have a meaning in motion. Meaning in every breath, there's a root to a breath, and there's an expression, and it returns back. Hmm. Okay?
Okay.
So that's when they say in the Neijing, yin-yang is the father and mother of all things, et cetera, et cetera. That's what they're talking about, that the universe is made on that. Now, what we know from physics today, most of the universe is intangible. So only 4% is what we call the baryonic universe or made up of atoms and things. But most of it's actually motion patterns of motion. So they seem to have got that. Then the breath starts to turn and it moves in different ways in different places. And in some places, it comes into organized motion. And that motion is the motion around a center. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when you look at the sun in the solar system, or if you look at the North Star and the constellations that are turning, that's called a five-level motion, meaning it has four sides to it in a center. That's the original meaning of wuxing, five circulations, or what's now called five elements. It meant that there's a basic pattern of motion in the universe, which is back and forth, which we call yin and yang. And sometimes it comes into an organized pattern, which means it's moving in a circle or a spiral, and we call that five. So right away, we have another thing here that they're defining, when you see all the numbers in Chinese medicine, which are called shu in the Neijing, 6, 9, 3, 2, 8, 1, that's an immediate clue as to what dimension of space-time breath they're talking about.
Okay, so we're able to attend at various levels. Various levels mean different things.
Right, so if you look out in space, things are either moving in and out or they're moving around in circles or spirals. Mm-hmm. When they're talking about it in an organized way, like around the pole star, they call it whooshing. Now, when you come down into the, so now say you have a, you're in a spacecraft and you start to come down into the atmosphere of our planet. Now we have another pattern because, well, as we know now, the Earth is tipped on its axis and it has a wobble, actually. Mm-hmm. So they see things that look like waves and other things like that. And the way nature looks locally is different, and it looks more like a sine wave. You don't see things moving around in circles so much on the Earth. You see more things like the waves in the ocean and things like that. When they, the term they use for that is six. So whenever you see the term six, it tells us now we're talking about a pattern that originates in our local world. And all of those patterns, resonant patterns, are superimposed on each other. So for example, if you look at the body anatomy, when we see five zong organs, it's telling us that the inside of our body is templated on the what I call the base pattern. It's the base pattern out in space of turning things turning around in a circle.
Which is very much a heavenly pattern.
Right. And the outer system, which is the channel system, is a six-level pattern because
based on physical form.
Right.
Of and this planet.
And what you see on the outside is on the arms and legs are the rivers. And the rivers, just like on the Earth, you see the rivers. And so they're moving in the same way. If you look at that, those terms like Jing, Jing is actually a cosmological term. It means a pattern of motion on our planet. And so when we see like Liu Qi, which means the six climates, they're talking about the local climates. They're not talking about this. The one, when they talk about heaven in the Neijing, they're talking about two heavens, actually. They're talking about the star heaven and the biosphere heaven. Mm-hmm. And the way you can tell the difference is if they use the number five or they're talking about music, because that's they recorded it all as musical notation, the turning of the stars, that they're talking about the heaven out in star in the star heaven. If they're talking about weather patterns or the number 6 or 12, they're talking about the local pattern. And those are different resonance patterns that move together to create a composite that we see. Another important part of this puzzle is that when you look at the forms of nature, you can infer the patterns because of a basic principle, which is that nature constructs its forms to facilitate the patterns that move through them. This is a really important principle.
The form comes out of the pattern.
Right. So, for example, if you look at a sand dune and you look at the sculptures in a sand dune, what you're seeing is where the wind, which is an intangible pattern, is moving across form, and it's making those grooves, basically. So you can infer backwards from looking at the sand dunes the pattern of the wind that made the sand dunes. This pattern, this was something that we used the example of Ernst Chladni a lot, who was a he was an 18th century physicist, and I don't know if you've ever seen his, he's the person who took a metal plate and he put sand on it, and then he had the violin bow and he bowed on it, and it started making geometric patterns.
Yes, yes, I've seen this. It's
right. So, and now we do it with a tone generator, and it makes, in it, what you see is that the sand will kind of bunch up on the side. What it's doing is allowing the vibration, the freest motion, by moving the form to the side. The other interesting thing there is if you turn a tone generator up on that, it makes numerically more complex patterns. So like when I was talking about how there's different numerical dimensions, it starts with yin and yang, and as it increases in energy, it becomes 5 and 6 and so forth, just like that plate. Now, if you have that idea, those places between the sand, the Chinese term for them is li, And li means, it means now principle or doctrine or something like that. But originally it meant graining pattern.
Mm-hmm. It's like the grain in wood or the grain in like a piece of fine jade would be the li of the jade.
That's the exact definition in one of the early dictionaries. And so it means that nature makes graining patterns in its forms. So, for example, if you look at a tree, you see the graining patterns, as you mentioned, and the body also has those graining patterns. Those graining patterns have, they go in two different ways. There are yang graining patterns that run from your feet up to your head and down. Mm-hmm. Like in a tree, there's the trunk. Mm-hmm. And there's the lateral graining patterns that run out to the surface, just like there's branches on a tree. So trees are actually alternating yin-yang growth patterns, basically. And so the graining patterns, and those two graining patterns in the body are called jing lo. If we get back to what Liu Jing means, originally jing meant vertical or axial graining patterns that are that form around space-time patterns that the body is templated on. Now, you can make the analogy of a river also. So for example, a river has a riverbed, mm-hmm. and there's a river. The river bed is the graining pattern. The river bed is the river. So in the same way, in the graining patterns of the body, which can either be in jing or lo, yin or yang patterns, there are graining patterns in the body that don't have blood, and there are ones that do. And the ones that do have blood are called jing mai, or jing lo. Mm-hmm. So just like in the earth, there's graining patterns that don't hold a river, but circulation kind of moves, some, you know, water will move through it, but it's not a river. And in some places, there's a river. So if you look at chapter 10 of the Lingshu, which is called Jing Mai, that's the chapter where most of the current channel systems are, their descriptions are built on, although they've been changed quite a bit. And what they're describing, what they say in the first paragraph of that is, in the world, in nature, there are rivers. In the body, there are my rivers, you know, and they follow the same patterns. And they actually compare all the main blood vessels in your body to major rivers of China. You may know that. And they're saying they follow the same pattern. They merge, they resonate together. Mm-hmm. So they're built on the same pattern.
And built on the same principle.
Built on the same principle. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the idea that the universe starts with breath, and so everything we see is an aspect of breath, of that initial breath. It's a kind of a version of it somewhere. And some parts of the breath are tangible and some of them are not. But even the parts that are tangible, that are form-based, we think they're not moving. They actually, everything's in motion. So I'm looking at a computer right now. It looks like a thing. But actually, if I sit here for 20,000 years, it would go away. So it's actually, it's an artifact of our consciousness that way. So everything's actually in motion. And so the basic definition of health for us from an aging point of view is places where the breath is not breathing, you know, where yin and yang is not flowing. So in the body, there are six primary jing graining patterns, and they are called tai yin, xiao yang, yang ming, and so forth. There's an upper and a lower version of those river courses, so they're called upper and lower tai yin, and so forth. In those graining patterns, there are sinews, we call them watersheds, because there are sinews that group around that river system, there are collateral beds that group around that, there are skin regions, there are bone regions. So it's an ecosystem, and they're all different. They're quite different. And that's where we get to the term jing. That's what Liu Jing originally meant. Now, if you look at also in the Lingshu, it's going to tell us channel symptoms, what we now know as channel symptoms, they were actually symptoms of problems of river flow. So for example, if they say in the upper Tai Yin Jing Mai watershed or the river system, when the river is too low, the symptoms will be this, you know, a kind of breathing problem. When the liver is too high, it's another one. When the river is too active, it's another one. When external wind blows into the river, because there was that idea that the environment really just, we're porous and the environment comes in and out of us, it causes another kind of problem. And so that's something we can, in terms of terminology, that does make sense. And the other important part of it is that it has an anatomical basis. So where we often have trouble talking to our counterparts in Western medicine is when we talk about things that, first of all, if we don't understand them, they kind of pick that up often, I think, if we're confused. Mm-hmm. But also if we're saying it's somehow magical, that cheese is somehow a magical energy that does all these things, But if we talk to them about, it's actually about motion patterns and about anatomy and bodies form this way, that was the point of view, and they make blood vessels, and when the blood vessels aren't circulating correctly, these are the symptoms, and it was found out partly through dissection and other things like that, then they're right on board with that usually.
I'm more on board with it too, because this idea that there's this magical force and we're somehow interacting with it in a magical way doesn't really work for me. I'm fine with interacting with something non-tangible, but I feel like I need to have something that I can stand on beyond move chi and it's going to be fine.
So, this work with the Neijing's now been about 20 years. I was horrified to realize last week talking to someone. And part of it's been trying to understand the terms and translate it. And what are they talking about? That took forever. How do you do it? That's another thing. How do you teach it? The essence of doing this kind of work is that when a person comes in with, say, breast cancer, that you should be able to back up to the beginning of the universe and say, I had that seed at the beginning of the cosmos. It started to breathe. It started to make patterns. It started to come into our world. Her body was formed on these patterns. There was a life history of this person. She had a certain Jing essence. This is why it all happened. And then, so that's actually kind of like our final exam in our course is like, start from the beginning of the universe, tell me why this person has breast cancer. So what that means is that's very important for, it's really also, here we're talking about the difference between physician level versus ancillary care thinking. Mm. And here I don't mean your licensing, I mean a way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And physician level care really means an ability to deal with complexity through an understanding of principle. And ancillary care is often more following protocols and things like that. They both have a value. So for example, if, say we were going to war tomorrow and we had to train 1,000 people in a month, we would not choose a physician level way of teaching them. We would teach them a protocol system and it would work much better. But the issue is now that most of what we do is protocol based and ancillary. It's not physician level care. Originally, in the descriptions of early text, it really was physician level thinking. I mean, they understood how nature operates, basically. And they were able to walk into a patient's room. And this is the experience I have. If I go into a hospital, say, and a person's very sick, there will be the rounding team, the cardiology team, infectious disease specialists, whatever, the cancer team, everybody's kind of in an uproar. The family's upset. The patient looks terrible. Great. I have to get the whole story. And then as my role as a, someone who practices in aging medicine, I have to stop and I have to kind of tune out all the details.
And you have to go back to the beginning of time.
Right. So like, I don't go back to the beginning of time every time, but I have to know that what I'm looking at. So part of the thing is that in aging medicine is that an impairment of patterning may be in one place, but the expression is in another. That's a really important thing. So this is very common that where the breath motion, the kind of the universal breath motion is stuck, is often silent, but it expresses out in a person in, say, as asthma or as breast cancer or something else. So our tendency is always to attend to the thing that's kind of yelling at us, that's making the most noise and it's right there in front of us. And our job is always to go back to the pattern behind that. So in the Neijing, they tell us again and again, the lower way is to look at the form. Mm-hmm. Like someone has breast cancer, stick needles around that. The higher way is to understand the pattern.
I remember in our previous conversation that you said this about the place where the problem is, it's often silent.
Mostly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten that you'd mentioned it until I just heard you say it. And I went, oh, Yes, I remember something about this. So, one of the things that I have been chewing on lately, I can't say I know it. I would say I have questions, not answers. And one of the big questions that I've had recently is looking at the six chi or six channels. Now I've got a slightly more differentiated way of looking at it after this conversation. Thank you for that. So often, we learn to look at pathology. And lately, I have had this question of, is there, this is air quotes here, okay? Again, I'm in the midst of working something out. Is there a proper physiology to these things? Because we have this idea that there's a Zheng Qi in the body. There's something that's upright, it's correct, it's supposed to do something, and it's doing it something that it's supposed to do. Is there a way of looking at these six great conduits, these six great watersheds, what's on this side of the curtain and the other side of the curtain, in a way where we're looking from the place of, oh, here's how it's supposed to work. This is how it looks when it's healthy. There's something that it's bringing to the table. Because so often I think about in our treatments, yes, we're looking to get rid of pathology. Yes, we're looking to hopefully treat illness, help it get better, go away. Is there a way that we can use the proper functions where they're not properly functioning or breathing, I guess you could say, using your language? And what would those proper functions be of these six great conduits? Does that question even make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay.
So the term Zheng is a really good example. You know, if we go back to the idea that there's a hierarchy in terminology, also the terminology makes sense. You know, it actually makes absolute sense when you understand it from the original source. Like most students, I think, have had this experience that we start school and we're very enthusiastic, but then we run into one thing, which is that we go to our 9 o'clock class, and when the teacher says it means this thing, and then we go to our 10 o'clock class, and they say it means another. And in one place, every pulse is slippery, and another one, every pulse is wiry, and so forth. And after, by the third year, people get a little cynical about it, and so forth. But so I really want to let people know that originally all these terms make sense, and they have a hierarchy, and the hierarchy is that they start as descriptions of how nature moves. So, for example, if you take the character Zheng, and if you had to take a test, and you know what is Zheng Qi, it's the Qi that fights illness or whatever, you know, restores your body. But then we fail what I call the 4-year-old test, often in Chinese medicine. You know, like if you have a 4-year-old, I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but if you have a 4-year-old, what do they do all day? They ask you these hard questions, like, you know, Daddy, why is the sky blue? And you say, well, it's you know, something or other. And then they say, why is it doing that? And then you ask, so if you apply the 4-year-old test to someone with Zheng Qi, and you say, what is Zheng Qi, Michael or someone? And you'll say, well, it's the Qi that fights illness. And then you say, what's the Qi that fights illness? You know, or what's Qi? And by about 3 or 4 questions, we're like a lost. We don't really know.
Actually, that 4-year-old has shown us all the holes in our understanding.
Yeah, and because it's like the emperor has no clothes, they don't know not to ask, you know, about it. But if we go back to the idea that terminology has a hierarchy, and it's first about patterns of motion, space-time motion. So what is Zheng? If you look at the early idea of Zheng, it means kind of like feet moving in the right way. And so what Zheng means is that circulation is moving in its normal pattern. What does that mean? In terms of yin and yang, breath in the middle of the cosmos, this means it's expanding out and returning back to a source. If you interrupt that, it's interrupting the Zheng flow. If you look at the seasons, it means that spring follows winter, summer follows spring. If you interrupt that patterning, it's an interruption in the Zheng flow. If you're looking in the body, it's how your blood vessels flow. So, for example, my lower yang, Ming River, which correlates also to the carotid artery system and the femoral artery system in their descriptions, it has a flow direction. If I put something in the middle of that, say I walk down to a river and I throw a big log in, the Zheng is the power of the water running down the river. the log is the obstruction pattern. Mm-hmm. When the obstruction pattern happens, things start flowing sideways.
That's right. It's trying to go somewhere.
So in acupuncture, the main contraindication is that people don't have a good pulse, which means like if it's very thin and they're weak and underfed, it means that there's no flow in their rivers. And the reason that's the main contraindication is because we are very dependent on the Zheng flow to restore order after we work on people. The Zheng flow is like if you're, it's the pressure running through your rivers. And then when I'm needling at an obstruction, it's the power that comes in after me and pushes things back to its normal way.
Mm-hmm. Clears out the obstruction after the obstruction has been broken up.
Right. So if we're dealing with acupuncture surgery to take out external cold, say someone had exposed to cold or even environmental things like air pollution or chemotherapy, or those are other pathogens that are now in tissue. What we're doing basically is restoring Zheng flow so that blood can push that back out through the collateral system and out the excretory systems out of the body. But we're very dependent on that. That's called Zheng Qi. So when you go back and you look at the original descriptions and you understand that they first come from patterns of motion, and we say that terms have a primary meaning and a secondary, or for example, Zheng has a capital Z term and a small Z term. So the capital Z is it's a pattern of breath motion that means it's moving in the right way. Small Z means in a person, it's the thing that helps them get over a cold.
Right. One side is, again, that this side of the curtain, so to speak.
Right. And the thing is, you cannot practice physician level medicine if you only understand the secondary meanings. So for example, if you say like, if we take yin and yang, for example, it's most terms are about space, time, motion. Yin and yang is talking about the inherent breath motion of the cosmos, which is the basis of everything. But in people, it looks like hot and cold, or male and female. So what we're taught is the secondary meanings of things. So you can recognize if someone's hot, we call it a yang syndrome. If they're cold, we call it a yin syndrome. But the problem is you can't practice physician level medicine from that. You can practice ancillary care, which means I saw a pattern, and it goes with a formula, it goes with points. But you can't walk into, say, the ICU and see someone who has heart failure and kidney insufficiency and breast cancer and make sense of it. Because all of a sudden there's way too many patterns and they're shifting all the time. But if you understand the first meaning, you can. And actually one of the wonderful things about an aging medicine is if you take that patient who's in the ICU, it's an overly complex situation. When you walk in, there's too many details. There's too many medications. They're all interacting. There's multiple rounding teams. It's just a mess, basically, mm-hmm. of complexity. And one of the amazing things about an aging medicine is you can walk into that and say, start from the beginning. The universe is a breath. It moves through patterns. It makes channel systems. The channels have symptoms. So you're taking complexity and reducing it to simplicity. But if you were to come at that as from a protocol-based system of TCM, you'd be like, well, it's kind of red there, it's phlegmy there, it's damp here, it's just kind of a mess.
Sure. Well, this is the thing that so many people complain about. It's like, oh, there's a little kidney insufficiency, and now, you know, and there's some blood stasis, and oh, the spleen isn't working. You know, by the time you get done, you've actually gone around all the five different phases, you found something that's showing up there, and you go, where do I go? Right? It becomes very confusing.
And if you go around and look at people's practices, they've had a variety of teachers who told them a variety of things, all with good intention mm-hmm. and experience. And they've kind of chosen in their own way, like, I like this one, I like a little of that one, I like a little of this one.
Yeah, we tend to cherry pick the stuff we like.
And the things that we get good feedback, it mm-hmm. works. It means everybody's really doing something quite different, usually. But I guess if your listeners don't hear anything else from me today, mm-hmm. it's I really want to let them know the Chinese medicine originally did make sense. All the terms make complete sense. They're tied to things in nature that you can see looking out your window. You can take those into the clinic and use them in very complicated cases through an understanding of these things, not by guessing, not by saying there's magic qi, but by going one step at a time and doing that. And it seems to be a remarkable approach to these complex diseases. And that's why we're working on this research center. And I have a hope that it's going to change how we treat global health illnesses too. So,
and I love the idea of going to simplicity in the midst of utter chaos. That somewhere in there, there's this li, right? There's this coherence, there's this principle that kind of pulls things together that we can rely on. It's reliable. Does that make sense?
It's as reliable as that the sun rises and the sun sets.
Okay, this is pretty reliable.
I mean, those are things, if you look at like how gene patterns happen in a tree, why are there vertical graining patterns in a tree? Because the sun rises and the sun sets. And when the sun rises, all the energy goes up in the leaves. And when the sun, you know, when in wintertime, it goes back down to the roots. And in nighttime, it goes back down. And so basically, there's a cycling pattern. And the tree forms a graining pattern around that.
And that's cycling.
Yeah.
So for those of us, you know, and I love it that you don't just talk about, oh, someone's got a little autoimmune thing going on. You're talking about you walk into an ICU or you're treating someone with cancer.
If you take autoimmune diseases, autoimmune diseases are so simple in how to approach them.
Ah, okay. How so? I'd love to hear a little bit about
that. So if you take, you walk down to the river, we have the idea of Zheng flow. It's in your river, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a force of the river coming down the mountain. We call that the Zheng flow. If you put something in it, it's going to push against that.
Right.
That's the power of the Zheng flow.
Yes.
If I walk down to the river and I throw a log in the river, it's going to run up against that and have turbulence. That turbulence is called counterflow. And the choppy turbulence is
Ni Qi. Right? It's not Shun. It's not going with the flow the way it should. It's
right.
Shun and Ni is a very basic concept that we have this way.
And that turbulence we see behind the log in Western medicine, we call that inflammation. Mm-hmm. So basically all, you know, autoimmune disease is very complicated in their descriptions and their syndromes and so forth. Just throw that out the window. When you see, well, I mean, you have to know something about Western medicine. Don't throw that out the window. But basically, whenever you see inflammation, it's again this thing about reducing complexity to simplicity. It means something's fallen in the river and it's causing counterflow. So if someone has autoimmune endocarditis or they have a heart valve issue, it means that there's a turbulent flow pattern going through their. Something's causing counterflow. It could be an infectious organism. It could be an environmental agent. It could be all sorts of things that gets in the tissue and it causes a counterflow problem. And that counterflow action we call inflammation. If the person's Zheng Qi is strong, like they're an infant, their counterflow, their reaction is very strong. So if a child gets an infection, the fever is very high, very quick. Mm-hmm. If you get an old person whose Zheng flow is weak, they can be very sick with an infection and you hardly see a rise in their temperature.
They just don't have the energy to mount a response.
You're not seeing the inflammatory response. Mm-hmm. So that means that for all those problems, you know, I'll certainly take the Western viewpoint into account, but what I'm going to do when I put on my aging hat is I'm going to say, there's an obstruction pattern that's causing counterflow. And the interesting thing is that those patterns get set up only for a few reasons. And there's basically five reasons that those things get set up. And that's so immensely helpful for us. They can be prenatal. There's two causes that are prenatal. One is that something runs in your family line. So everyone has kidney cysts and you have kidney cysts too, you know. Another is something that happened during the mother's pregnancy and how your body is set up. And there's more and more we know how much things go on there. And you can tell prenatal factors of obstructive flow patterns by the fact that when the baby comes out, they have them right away. They have the problems right away. And there's three postnatal causes. And they are, one is a category called guest host illnesses. And it means that something's in your body that's not of you.
So this would be like pollution, environmental factors.
Exactly. Originally in the Neijing, it was all environment, cold, wind, damp. And these weren't metaphors for viruses. They were actually cold is moving through your channel system. Mm-hmm. Because there's no blood there and there's no circulation there, so it will come and lodge there. But now it means all sorts of things. It means chemotherapy. It means air pollution, all sorts of things. And as a matter of fact, it's so bad, we have this whole safety issue now where we have to use protective gear to take things out of people because it's not healthy for the practitioner when we use these techniques.
What kind of things are we talking about here?
Like air respirators. Mm. You know, if someone comes in with chemotherapy, it won't happen so much if you're using TCM approaches, which don't really unlock these patterns in the same way. But when we're doing this kind of acupuncture surgery, you might say, to unblock the holding pattern of breath, when we hit that pattern and unblock it, all of a sudden, breath starts to move and things that are trapped in tissue dumps into the blood and starts to come out in breath and sweat pores and things like that in a very tangible way.
So the doctor doesn't want to be exposed to that.
Right. So one of our first studies down in Los Angeles will be to do exhaled gases studies on chemotherapy patients. And you only have to look at what people wear when they mix up chemotherapy, which is a hazmat suit and, you know, a ventilator system. And they have to change those canisters every 4 or 5 hours because they go bad. So it's really toxic stuff, which again, won't really affect you if you are doing a TCM practice.
But if you're actually really releasing that stuff.
Right. What we found is that and this is through basically my experience of trial and error and getting sick and so forth, and then getting better, that we're having to wear protective gear, and we're trying to figure that out right now because it's a whole new thing.
This really makes sense. I was clued into this a while ago about cupping from Bruce Bentley, who's the cupping master of the universe. And he talks about that cupping can really pull cold out. And here's how you know. When you release that cup, it'll feel like you just opened the refrigerator. And I have absolutely seen this where I'll open up a cup and it's icy cold where that cup had been. The other thing that he mentioned was do not open that cup in a way that it's pointing at you. You open it up where it's going away because that stuff is really bad news.
So I'm glad you brought that up because cupping is a health risk for people now. And cupping is very, we know from other studies that, and just our experience also, that cupping takes out things like chemotherapy, air pollution, heavy metals, it takes it out of the bloodstream into the cup. And so cupping is one place in a standard TCM practice where there is a health risk currently. And so actually, if you are cupping, honestly, my recommendation would be to put on a respirator with a respirator mask that people use when they're, you know, doing auto body painting and something like that, with an organic solvent canister. Can't just be a dust canister. And the way that we do cupping, first of all, we're protected. We try and do it with ventilation, like windows and things like that, open if possible. And then when you take the cup off, don't just take the cup off, but have a tray and crack it and put it right down on the tray. So mostly people kind of crack them and then they walk around in the room waving them around and so forth, or leaving them on the side table and things. So you crack it, you put it right on the tray, then you take that into a tub with water and disinfectant, and you just dump it right in there. And actually what we're having to explore down in Los Angeles is the idea of making a clean room, which is like a kind of a place with a good ventilation system where people have protective gear when they're in there. And it's a place where we place people that we know have a high burden of something, and we treat them there for a period of time before they come back into a normal treatment room. But it means also...
It means freaking your patients out.
You know what's interesting? That's what I thought. It actually, the patients don't mind. Mm. It's kind of... You would think.
Yeah, no, I'm imagining wearing a respirator like you just described. Yeah, I'm going to put these cups on and, you know, I'm suiting up. They're like, what? I don't know how I would pull this off.
One of our students down in LA started wearing the respirator and stuff while he's working. And I've had this experience with patients. They don't really care, but especially if you explain it. And actually, they're very happy that something's coming out of their body. And one of the comments of a patient to Peter down there when he started using it was, man, if you use this, you're going to have a line at your door because it's so interesting and people know that you're getting stuff out of them. And but it's really, I thought that would be a problem with patients. It's never once been a problem with patients if you explain it to them.
Okay.
Yeah. Where it is a problem, mm-hmm. it's with us. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, we had a practicum, a six-day class this fall, and it was the first time where we really asked the students, we had some patients come in, and we really asked them to wear protective stuff. And we're kind of trying to feel our way through this, like, what are our safety obligations and mm-hmm. how do we do this? And it's more of a mental block for us. The patient didn't care at all. For us, it's like, it's a huge deal because we go into natural medicine. We want it to be natural. And then the idea you have to go to the hardware store and, you know, buy this thing is really, it's not anything I ever wanted to do. But it's actually, I would say it might be, it's certainly one of the biggest global health issues right now is that we're finding that there's so much more in people than we thought there was. Mm-hmm. And it turns
we're
out
exposed to so much more, like you were just saying. And when I think about all the pharmaceuticals that have been in the world, you know, in the past 50 years, and they're in the water supply, there's all kinds of stuff
everywhere.
That we're exposed to that we just were not exposed to previously.
And it turns out that as far as I can tell, the body is like a big sponge.
Mm-hmm.
And it has and for our survival, it has a great capacity to hold things and still function.
Mm-hmm.
And it does it by sequestration and compaction. So when things come into your body, say, in terms of the guest host illnesses, let me forget to mention the other two.
Okay.
Causes.
Yeah. No, we're going to come back to that, but we might have to do a whole new session on guest host illnesses. We'll see.
Okay. Actually, the naging is all about guest host illnesses, and for them, it was the environment. This goes back to what we said in the beginning about if you don't understand the terminology and the ideas, you can't innovate.
Mm.
So if
so kind of like, you know, you have to know the scales on your guitar before you can play something jazzy.
Exactly. So for example, what is innovation? Like when I think about all the Chinese medicine conferences I've been going to since 1992, yes, there's always some new thing. There's always some new take on something. But basically, we have the same questions. We're having the same conversations. Yes, there's a new guy on the state, you know, up there who's got a thing, but we're not innovating in the same way. I said, like when I graduated and the person said 40% of what you did is out of date. What is innovation? You know, and you think, well, maybe Chinese medicine is not something that changes all the time because it's traditional. But if you look at the history of Chinese medicine, it's of continuous innovation.
Mm.
And what does innovation mean? It means taking basic principles that come from your source knowledge, from your early texts,
mm-hmm.
and looking at the problems in the world today and making a solution. So, for example, you know, when the Wenbing text came out, the fever school text, it was because of epidemic illnesses, and they were innovating to meet that challenge. What are our challenges today? Climate change, the opioid crisis, environmental toxicity, all of those things. So innovation means that we take the original ideas from these people who understood how the universe worked, how nature operates, and we apply them. So it means something like taking heavy metals, chemotherapy out of people in clean rooms with respirators. That's what it looks like to innovate in this way. It's very strange. I never thought I'd be doing that, but we've been driven to that over the years. And it's a huge problem. We don't understand how much is in people. It's a really big issue.
You know, you and I were talking before we started rolling tape about how surprising it is that we're living the lives that we're living, that we're exploring the things that we're exploring, that there's small seeds that we thought we planted at one point, but oh my God, now it's our life and it's complex and we're busy. And there's all these things that we have this great fortune to be working with that we never could have imagined previously. And so, you know, here you are talking about working in a clean room, maybe pulling chemotherapy out of a patient. And when I first hear you talk about it, I go, well, yeah, you know, is that really so? And then you mention about how they mix it up in clean rooms. And it's like, oh, no one's talking about this other side of it. You know, I know sometimes when people have radiation treatments, like to kill bone marrow so they can get a bone marrow transplant, they have to be isolated for a few days because they're radioactive, right? And you don't want to hurt the people around you. Sounds like we might want to be considering that things that we thought were safe, maybe they're not so safe.
Yeah, and It goes. We were talking about planting seeds, and we were joking about how we thought we were going to be retiring, and we're not retiring. And I originally started reading these, as I said, just because I thought I should read them. You know, that's what you should do. And what I think it's a very special time right now for these seeds to be planted again. Mm-hmm. That the information here, I mean, both about how nature works in terms of climate change, our environment. There's so much information there. But also about bringing these ideas back so we can make kind of a Chinese medicine 2.0, if you were, mm-hmm. you know, that we kind of refresh it. We do a hard refresh.
Right. Well, isn't it true? I mean, like you were saying, back in the Wenbing times, they did kind of a reboot. They're taking basic fundamental principles, applying it to the current new situation that has never been experienced before.
Yeah. So if you want to do a reboot, you know, say you're having a problem in your marriage or your job or whatever, the first thing to do is to stop what you're doing and go back to what you know to be true. Hmm. You know, like you can have a bad situation like the patient in the ICU, and you can add one more complicated thing on that. Or in your marriage, you can like not go back to the root of problems, but you can add one more thing, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to build like an extra a room on a house that's already shaky. So if we take TCM right now, again, if you want to train people in a protocol system, it ain't bad. You know, if you're going to war and you need to train 1,000 people in a week. But also what we have now, I call the image I have for where we are now is that it's the terminal marine of Chinese medicine history. A terminal marine is like in the mountain where all the rocks fall down and then it's a big pile of rocks. Mm-hmm. So right now in TCM, it's a big pile of rocks of different techniques that aren't really put together in a certain way. The terms aren't really understood and you can't really do anything from that. Mm-hmm. So you have to go back to, the first thing is you have to say, was there anything true in this tradition to begin with and what was it? And, you know, it was written down very well in these books, it turns out. And they're talking not only about about the truth of our traditions, what the terms mean, but also the truth of what the world means, of what nature means, of how it works. It's an incredible book for that. So we have to kind of be willing not to just try and tack an improvement onto it, but say, let's redo this. You know, let's go back to the beginning.
Back to basics.
For example, in our training programs, if you imagine Chinese medicine as a tree and, you know, the Neijing or natural science from the Warring States is the root, we're way out here in the leaves in TCM. Mm-hmm. And so we try and make sense of it from that point of view, sitting on a leaf, like we're a bug out there on the leaf. If we flipped our educational system and started at the root, then everything would make sense that came after that, including TCM. If you sit out on the leaf, nothing makes sense, basically.
Yeah, I see your point. Let's get through these other two reasons, and then we're probably going to have to come back and have another conversation on guest and host, because that sounds super powerful.
And actually, climate change. You know,
climate change is part of the guest and host thing?
No, if you go back to that model of there's the stage and the curtain and the mm-hmm. patterns behind the curtain, mm-hmm. we're worried about the things on the front side of the stage, that the oceans are rising, that there are wildfires. Those are all what's really the big story in climate change is that we're changing the resonance patterns upon which life has based itself. So if we go back to that model of the sand dunes or the graining patterns in trees, our bodies have evolved to function on rhythmic patterns. That's, you know, and we're disrupting those patterns. So we're disrupting biological coherency. That's actually the big issue.
So we're changing the lee of the planet.
Right. So if you look at plants and animals today, they're confused because the patterns of motion have changed mm-hmm. and forms are patterned on those patterns. So our body was patterned to function on a certain set of patterns, and we're changing those patterns.
We're changing those patterns. Okay.
Yeah. Man. Anyway, the other two are emotional diseases mm-hmm. and trauma. And so that is such an incredibly helpful model. If I go into the ICU, I'm going to look at that situation. I'm going to think about natural patterns. And basically, through the narrative and the exam, I'm going to try and understand their illness in terms of five different causes. And those are two prenatal and three postnatal. And that's it.
It's helpful.
Oh, it's so helpful.
It's super helpful. I'm just looking at this after you saying it. I just wrote it down here. And I mean, trauma is super simple, right? That's easy to recognize. And Western medicine is super good at treating that, by the way.
Yeah, and trauma also is surgery.
And trauma is surgery. It's a, you know, it's a controlled trauma.
Yeah.
Okay.
So often we're dealing with results of surgery is one of the things we deal with all the time.
Right. Often a lot of cold trapped in the body from that too.
Oh yeah. Huge. Operating rooms are freezing.
Yeah, man. It's like a meat locker.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So that's so, like, if you think of the person, the next person you see with Lyme disease and they have six medical charts and it's been 15 years and you're going to do a narrative history and go, and there's also this idea we call the inflection point where the obstruction pattern came in. Mm. It happens at a specific time. And then all these things happen. And we're all dealing with the things that are happening down the road.
Right.
But you go back to the inflection point. That's when I fell out of a canoe into an icy lake or something like that.
And that's where, if you can touch that and change that, then downstream things naturally, if they've got some Zheng Qi, it's going to dredge itself back out.
Right. So it's so, I can't tell you as a physician how wonderful it is to only have five things to look for.
Oh man, this is great. Well, I need to get rolling because I have to get to clinic in a little bit and I'm going to walk in with these and just see what I see. So I super appreciate this. It's always a delight to talk with you. I come away looking at the world in a whole different way. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.